Good morning, my name is Dave Dawson, I'm an alcoholic. What a gorgeous morning this is. You know, as I was coming down here this morning, I got sober on the morning of June 23rd, 1990. It was a Saturday morning. I was in the hospital near death. And I couldn't help but to reflect as I was driving down here this morning how different this Saturday morning is than what I brought to you all almost 24 years ago in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if there is a single thing in my life that I must point to and must owe my eternal gratitude for that had brought me from laying on a hospital bed more dead than alive at 22 years old and the man that I have a chance and a life that I have a chance to lead today is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so, you know, as I have a chance to share my story this morning, I hope, if nothing else, you believe that I believe AA works for me. And if you get any more out of that, that'll be awesome. It'll be great. But if nothing else, you give me an opportunity to get up early on a Saturday morning to drive from my home in Maryland down and stand at a beautiful place and get a chance to 12-step myself and remind me of the life that you all have given me. So I thank you for that. I also want to thank Billy. You know, when Billy first called me and asked me if I could come down and do this, you know, Billy just has this voice and this sort of gentle southern hospitality. He just radiates gentleness and love. You know, and I thought, my God, I don't know how anybody could say no to Billy in anything, right? And I was thinking, boy, if I could have that tone and that warmth at work, I could probably get people to do anything I wanted them to do at work, right? Which is always one of my biggest struggles in terms of the 12th step and practicing the principles in all my affairs. And so thank you, Billy, for the invitation, and thank you all for the warm welcome and for having me down here on this Saturday morning. You know, there's a paragraph in the Big Book that I like to read that really describes my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I try to use that as a way just to kind of start things so that hopefully I don't spend, you know, out of the next, you know, 55 minutes, hopefully I don't spend 45 minutes drunk, right? And then only have 10 minutes left to talk about, you know, that more than half of my life has been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. 45 years old, got sober at 22, almost 46. And so more than half of my life has been spent being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And having had the blessing, I was talking to Al earlier, having had the blessing of truly standing on the shoulders of giants. You know, and Al and I were talking a little bit about the giants that we've been blessed, whose shoulders we are blessed to stand on, who've now gone on to the big meeting in the sky. And so, you know, as I talk here today, I hope some of the words of, you know, those who have gone on before us, those giants whose shoulders that I was blessed to stand upon, I hope some of those words are echoed forward. And I hope they continue to be echoed forward to the generations yet to come in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I thank you for that. And let me read this one paragraph that I love. And it's out of Bill's story. And this is Bill reflecting on his experience with Ebbie Thatcher coming to 12-stepping. And Bill says this about his experience with Ebbie when he came to 12-stepping. But my friend sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in fact, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap of humanity to a level of life better than the best have ever known. And if I had to tell my story in Alcoholics Anonymous in two sentences, it would be, I have been taken from the scrap heap of humanity to a level of life better than the best have ever known. And I could sit down now and you would know my story. But since we got 55 minutes left... Our Big Book tells us to describe in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what my life has been like with the last couple decades with you all. And I think it's a little bit important to talk about, a little bit about the fundamental nature of my disease called alcoholism. And the fundamental nature of my disease is my first sponsor, Tom Flynn, talked about, who's off in the big meeting in the sky now. Tom said he wasn't a problem drinker, he was an answer drinker. And I love that description, because what it describes for me is that, see, what makes me an alcoholic is not what alcohol does to me. And there's lots, probably like many of us in this room, man, there was lots of tragic, terrible, horrible stories about what alcoholism did to me. But it's what alcohol does for me that makes me an alcoholic. Because what it does for me, I'll let it do anything to me. Right? And what alcohol does for me is, you know, it really does some kind of magic that you can't really describe to a non-alcoholic and have them appreciate it. And the best way I can describe the magic for me is when the first time that I took my first real drink and it did that magic. And I think that'll be illustrative of when I talk about being an answer drinker, of what I mean by that. I was 13 years old. I was a bit east of here in the city of Richmond, Virginia. I was working summer times. I was in between 8th grade and 9th grade. So when I grew up, that's between middle school and high school. So I'm getting ready to start high school. And I've got my first real summer job. And I'm working for a trucking company in Baltimore in a place called Pigtown, which as it probably sounds, it's not exactly an upscale neighborhood in Baltimore. I guess demographically and it was about as far down blue collar as you can go until you get that line to just sort of trash, right? You know, it's sort of like you're all the way down, the people are barely working, they drink every day, you know. It's just a wild place to be. And I kind of loved it. It was, you know, that's where I kind of gravitate to. When I drink, not only do I get down to that line, I like going down below that line, right? I become, you know, the lower companion. That's sort of my MO. So let me be clear. I'm not judging, you know, because I love that kind of, and I was immediately drawn to it. It's one of these places where, you know, there's little, you know, little townhouses that half the people pay their rent, half don't. You know, there might be electric cords running out from one to the other because somebody's, you know, electric got shut off. You know, one of those places where they leave the stove on because that's the only way they heat the house, right? You know, that kind of place where there's a bar on every corner, and you got bail bondsmen on every other corner, right? That kind of place. And a lot of industry around there. So a lot of trucking companies and kind of heavy industry So I started working summers up there. They had a big job going on down in Richmond, Virginia, and it was loading up a bunch of furniture at a big condominium. And the company that I work for, that's mostly what we did. We did kind of high end clientele, moving nice furnished, usually like in, you know, corporate kind of thing for executives. And so I wound up down in Richmond, Virginia, at this big job for this big VP at some company in Richmond there. And it was right downtown, and the building's still there. When I go by it, I can point at it. And it was sort of a upscale condos. It was, you know, probably about 12 stories high. And this guy had a condominium, a couple thousand square foot condominium, like the top floor. And so it was one of these places that was just gorgeous, you know, had these 12 foot ceilings and these beautiful windows that overlooked the city of Richmond. It was really nice. And we worked all day, and I was a 5 foot tall, 110 pound kid. And I was taught a good work ethic. You know, I was raised by, you know, good blue collar, hard working men that taught me what it means to show up and give your best for a day's pay. And I was raised with good morals and good values. And so when I talk about standing on the shoulders of giants, it's not only the people in AA. I want you to hear that. Not everybody has that story of being raised well and being loved. I do. And I don't want to take that away from the people who poured out their love. Like my grandparents, they poured out their love to me their whole lives until they took their last breath to try to see me have the life that I have today. They're very much the principles that I live by today are exactly the principles they live by. They just weren't alcoholics. See, I need this to allow me to live the way that they tried to teach me to live my whole life. So I want to say that. Not everybody has that story, but I do. And, you know, I was this 13-year-old kid. My father had gotten killed in Vietnam. And you know, I always felt kind of different. I felt like I didn't fit in, you know, but I was down there in Richmond working as hard as I could. And you know, the end of the day, you know, we're covered in our own sweat. It was one of those summer days, you know, in Richmond where it was, you know, 99 degrees and 99% humidity. And we've been working in the back of a truck and running upstairs and downstairs and, you know, moving big, heavy furniture all day long. And the real men are sitting in little boxes in the corner. We got about half the library unloaded. And we're sitting on boxes. We've got another full day of this tomorrow. And they're reaching into a brown paper bag, and they're all drinking a beer. And it looked like one of those sort of like Budweiser commercials, right? Where you expect the Clydesdales to come like racing through with a frosty air, right? You know, like the perfect end of the day, you know, the hard-working men having enjoyed a nice cold beer, you know, after covered in their own sweat, you know, and hard work, you know. And I'm the little scared kid standing on the wall watching the real men drink. You know, have you ever felt like you're kind of on the outside of the circle and you really want to be part of the circle, but you don't have the courage just to walk up and invite yourself in? You know, and one of the guys, and this will tell you a little bit about the kind of guys I worked with. His name was Joe, and he had a nickname. He was from New York, and they called him Joe Balls. And Joe talked like this. And Joe Balls had the nickname Joe Balls because he was known to be a man, you know, of great courage and fortitude. And if you didn't believe him, he was liable to hit you, right? And so Joe Balls is sitting there on his box, and he looks over at me with his New York accent, and he reaches in the bag, and he says, "You've done the work of a man today, Dave. Have a drink with us." And he tossed me a 16-ounce ice-cold Budweiser can. I still remember it. I remember I caught it in the air, and it was like the room went silent and still for a moment. And this really isn't just me talking. This is, I can remember it, like yesterday, right? There's all kinds of things. I can't remember what I had for lunch yesterday, but I can remember at 13 catching that beer in the air, feeling the coldness, looking at the condensation running down the can, taking about 5 steps over, pulling up my little box that was full of books. It was heavy when I moved it. I mean, not looking like I was trying to look like I wasn't straining when I did it. It was a strong man. And sat down with the men and then began to watch what they did. And so these are some of the skills that as alcoholics we learn, right? I don't know what I'm doing. I've taken sips off of the neighbor's beer before. I have a little bit off of mom's pina colada. But I've never sat down in a circle with the men and drank. And I know this is a turning point in my life. This is a great honor because it's not that I'm an alcoholic. It's that I'm a 13-year-old boy. You know, and for those men who are out there, and maybe it's the same for the women, I tell you what, there is nothing more that a 13-year-old boy wants than to be a man. And to be invited into the circle of men, right? And be part of that, right? And maybe it's the same for women, I don't know, but I can tell you, you know, that was what I wanted more than anything. And I wanted to fit in, so I watched what they did. And when they got done their beer and they crushed the can, you know, I hurried up and finished mine and I tried to crush the can and, you know, hurt my hand and they reached into a bag and grabbed the second one. Nobody had to hand me one the second time. I reached into the bag myself. Because that's what they did. And about halfway through that second beer, the magic happened. And the magic was like this for me. I went from the scared little 5-foot-tall, 110-pound kid, you know, raised by a single mom in kind of a run-down house on the edge of the country and always feeling like I didn't quite fit in with the rest of my friends and never quite had the same kind of stuff they did, you know, so all of a sudden, I got about half of that Budweiser, second Budweiser down, man, and I stood up. I couldn't seem to help but stand up. And when I stood up, it seemed like the floor dropped 6'4" below me. And the shoulders kind of stuck out to here, and it just felt like there was a strength that came through my body. And I felt like a man, you know. And that's what alcohol does for me. Now that night, I drank as much as I could. At some point, I came to I have a blackout at about 12:30 at night, because I remember looking at my little watch. They had found some little bar, snuck me in the back, and were feeding me slow gin. Right? And here I am, I kind of come out of this blackout, and I'm drinking this red sweet liquid, and I'm looking at my watch going, man, this is great, you know. My little friends are home after a big day of bike riding and baseball. And I'm down here loading trucks and drinking with the men. Wait till I tell them, you know? And that's about the last thing I remember until the next morning. And I came to, and this is, again, sort of I want to describe, this is sort of, you know, part of the skills of being an alcoholic. That just seem to be, they come natural to me, which is also part of why I think I'm an alcoholic, is these kind of skill set of, you know, watching what people are doing and trying to fit in and, you know, and seeing what's going on around me, constantly analyzing the situation to make sure that I'm sort of, you know, optimally placed to be in the group, you know, part of the group, right, fitting in. The same thing happened the next morning. I woke up. I didn't know where I was. Didn't remember the night before. remember bits and pieces of it, but not all of it. And this was new for me. Never had this happen before, right? Blackout, right? There's nobody in the room with me. I'm 13 years old. I look up at the ceiling, and there is red liquid on the ceiling. And there is red liquid and vomit all over me. And on the side, right side of me, on the left side of me. And I quickly discovered that I am covered in some kind of red liquid vomit. I didn't realize the night before it was sloe gin, until later. Put the pieces together. And I'm alone. Now, a lot of 13-year-old kids in this situation may have a different reaction than I had. The reaction I had was this. Okay. Guess they didn't want to be in the room with the projectile vomiting 13-year-old. Get it. Right? No clue where I'm at. No clue where the men are. That I'm a kid. I'm 13 years old, right? As much as I want to be a man, I'm a scared little kid the next morning. All alone in a city that I don't know where I'm at, and I don't know where the people were that I was with the night before. No clue. But I know, intuitively, as an alcoholic, you don't just like walk out the door and go find some adult and go, I'm scared. I don't know where I am. Can you help me? I've lost the people I came. I know that's not what you do. That's not what real men do. Right? I knew what I had to do was I had to get cleaned up, because you can't go out looking like this. I knew there was a job to finish, and so there was part of that, you know, good working class, blue collar upbringing that said, doesn't matter if you feel like crap, doesn't matter which where you are, you gotta go finish that job, boy. Get yourself cleaned up, get yourself some clothes on, get ready to go to work. That's the way I was taught. So that was just sort of natural. That was a good thing, by the way. I don't think that's alcoholism. I think that's good teaching, right? And so I got cleaned up. And I walked out the door. You know, we talk about living by faith in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, not really knowing what's in front of us, taking one day, one moment at a time, and just walking forward with faith. I walked forward out that hotel room in faith that somehow all would be made clear to me. That somehow, if I just showed up, that I would figure out what the next steps were. And so I walk out the door, and I start down the hall, not knowing where I am, not knowing really where the guys are. And I see Joe coming down the hallway. So I'm like, oh, good, it's Joe. But I couldn't, you know, I also kind of learned that there's kind of almost like a poker face that you have to put on when you've been in a blackout. Right? You don't want to show yourself. Right? I don't want to go to Joe. Oh, my God, Joe, I'm so glad to see you. I have no clue what the hell went on the night before. Can you please fill me in? Because I'm scared. Right? No, you don't do that. So I just watched Joe. As I walked up to him, and I'm waiting for Joe to kind of show me, like, okay, am I a jerk? Am I a hero? What's going on, right? So I look for that, and it seems like it's an eternity before Joe kind of shows, you know, and so a little grin comes across Joe's face, and he walks up to me, and he slaps me on the shoulder, and he goes, how you doing today, Tiger? You ready to fight? And I knew, once he smiled and showed me that it was okay, whatever had happened the night before, it was okay. And I found out later, it was almost getting drunk, blacking out, and wanting to fight. I was 13 years old, right? That was kind of like almost a rite of passage for these guys. They're like, oh, he's one of us? Man, it does my heart good to see a young man like that, you know? There's hope for the future, right? Yeah. And so whenever, you know, the rest of that summer, I was just one of them, right? And that I was embraced as part of that. You know, part of that trucking community, and I drank that way. And what I want to say is that I basically continued to drink that way. You know, the frequency became greater, the intensity higher, the price that I would pay larger. And by the time I was 17, kind of getting ready to graduate from high school, a lot of that good moral teaching that I had been brought up with had already been eroded to the point where the man that I was becoming was quickly not at all what people around me recognized in terms of who Dave Doss was, right? And people began to realize there's something really wrong with this kid's drinking. Anybody that knew me and loved me knew that there was something going on. And I wasn't 5 foot tall and 110 pounds anymore. I'm a good bit smaller now than I was in high school. I was the strongest guy in my graduating class. And I was 6 foot 2 and 220 pounds, and there was not an ounce of fat on me. And when I got drunk and violent, went into a blackout, bad things happened. And things began to happen for me, like I was dating this beautiful little blonde cheerleader girlfriend, and that I was my high school sweetheart, you know. And you know, with your first love, you know how it is. You're sure that you know you're going to spend the rest of your lives together, you know. And I loved this girl, I really did. And in a blackout, I beat her up in front of 200 people at a graduation, high school graduation party. I got suspended from the first time from high school. You know, I got arrested for the first time. All within a couple week period. Right? I got arrested for stealing a car in a high speed chase. Right? Now, fortunately, the stolen car, I was able to convince my friend who was, I had borrowed it from to say that it was really borrowed, not stolen. But nonetheless, I had, you know, driver's license that I was 21 years old. I was doing 130 mile an hour on a 40 mile an hour zone, turning the headlights off and literally in a high speed chase with the police officers in the middle of the night, dark drunk. Right? They throw you in jail for that. You know, I didn't realize they threw you in jail for that. I tried to tell them I was a varsity athlete in three sports and an honor student. Right? And that this was the first brush with the law, and that I'd appreciate it if they would just give me my tickets and send me home. And they drew their guns, and they took me to jail. And my grandfather came and got me out of jail. Now, see, I was at the time, I was living with my mother's parents, my maternal grandparents, who were straight-laced, right? This was, you know, this was the grandfather and grandmother who didn't drink, didn't smoke, you know, just salt of the earth. You know, when you think of the greatest generation, you think of people like my grandfather and my grandmother. You know, my grandfather's one of those guys, went in World War II at 17, came out at 22 when it was over, fought on both the Atlantic and the Pacific campaign in the Navy, you know, came home and then built the community he lived in, and lived there for 60 years, right? And was respected and admired and a man of great character and principle. My grandmother was a stereotypical, amazing Christian, gentle, loving woman. Just showed Jesus through how she lived, right? And did anything she could. She gave her last dime to try to help someone. Those were those kind of people. And then there was my father's parents. My grandfather was sober in AA 13 years at a time. But I had heard the stories of him stealing cars and wrecking shit, tearing shit up. My grandmother sewing him up, beating him with a bat at night while he was drunk. I mean, that was that side of the family, right? They come from, I guess probably, it's probably only just Blue Ridge further down, Roanoke, Withville, way down in the tip of Virginia. Good bit west of here, right? So that's that side of the family, right? And so guess who I called when I'm locked up in jail? I called Granddad Doss. I said, hey, I'm locked up. I hear you've been here before too. You think you can come get me out of this mess? And so he came over and got me, and he's talking to me on the way back. And I'm explaining to him that it's not that I have a drinking problem. I had the lack of a fast enough car problem. The car that I had borrowed, right, I found out later, when you take a car without someone's permission, it's usually called Grand Theft Auto, not borrowing, did not have a big enough engine to outrun those police officers. That was really my fundamental problem, not that I had been drinking. And he looked at me, you never have a newcomer sitting in the car next to you, and they're telling you something that's just absolutely insanity, just crazy talk. And you look at him like, do you really believe that? And that's exactly the look he gave me, like, do you really believe that? And he looked at me for a second, and he's driving while he's doing this, and he's like, and then I see him just do this. Oh, he does. Oh, no, he started doing this, like, oh, it's going to be bad for this kid. You know, it literally took him 40 years to get one. It took my grandfather 40 years to get one. And there are men, there's still a few of them left around the area that who actually 12-stepped him. And what an amazing blessing to get sober with some of the men and women who were here to give it to my grandfather 20 years before I got here, right? And what a blessing. What a powerful thing to see and be a part of in Alcoholics Anonymous. And as they say, I'm already doing it, right? I'm almost halfway done, and I haven't gotten sober yet. hell, I'm only 18 years old at this point. So that began the period of really was a turning point for me when, you know, I'm standing in front of judges, when the girlfriend's got that broken, teared up eye, you know, just destroyed look. Like, how could you do this? This is not you. When my good friends who I grew up with, I mean, these are, you know, men and women that knew me my whole life are saying, Dave, what the hell is wrong with you? And I decided, there's something wrong. I'm going to get this under control. And I pull out my willpower, you know. And like many of you, there are times in my life where I pull that willpower and amazing things can get done with it. You know, I can be determined. And I can make things happen when I try real hard. And I had a lot of success. For a kid that was sort of raised the way I was with the background I had, I was the best student in almost any school that I ever went to, right? And, you know, I was smart. God gave me a good bit of intellect. I tried to destroy it as best I could, as you'll hear a little bit shortly. And you still may believe that I did a pretty good job destroying it, depending on how well you think this talk's going, right? And you know, so I was able to say, education is important. I'm going to exert my will and do well there. Because I believe that was the path for me to a better life for me and my family to come. And I had this idea, I had this dream, and you'll hear me re-echo this again. When I was a little kid, and on a day like today, you know, that where I grew up was not quite this rural, but had a lot of this kind of feel to it. And I'd lay back on a hill on a day like today and feel that sun pour, you know, down on me, look up that bright blue sky, and I could almost feel my soul. I knew there was a God that loved me. You know, this was long before drinking. This was long before those teenage years where I really began to pull away from that. There was something inherent in me that went back and is now there again today. It lets me know on a day like today that the world and this place and this universe is much bigger than me, and that there is a God and He does love me. And there were hopes and dreams that one day, maybe one day, that God would use my life and I'd be able to have a chance to have the kind of family that I wish I would have had. That what my father had wanted for me and my mother when he went off to Vietnam and got killed, that one day maybe I'd get a chance to live that dream and build that dream for me and my family. And you'll hear that Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed that to happen. And that one day maybe I get to be the kind of father that I wish I could have had. Right? And so those were the thoughts that I kind of began to carry forward, and I began to see a road and be torn down and stripped away until those things were just gone by the time I was 18. And I began to try to control my drinking because I wanted to get those things back. I didn't want to be the man that I could see myself becoming. And what I found is I couldn't beat it. What I found is I was great at quitting drinking, and for 3.5 years, in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I came to you all, I wasn't even legal drinking age yet in the state of Maryland. I was 19. And I walked into the rooms, and it seemed like everybody had gray hair, no hair. Right? And there were really old people like me who had they're like 45. You know, they were really old. We had a guy, just to give you a sense of where I was at, there was this guy that drank with us who was 23. I was 19. And we called him Grandpa. That's the perspective of age. So the Bowie Speakers group is on Friday night, Speakers meet in Bowie, Maryland, my home group. If I was there last night. The young lady that celebrated 2 years last night is probably 25, 26, right? The average age of that group is under 30, and then we got a lot of folks that come in as teenagers and stay sober. I'm the old guy. I'm like really the old guy. Like the group conscience, there's like everybody else that like kind of starts to get up in their 30s, and then there's me, right? And I love that group because kids like me, when I was 19, could walk into a place like that. And the leap isn't too far. Now, I was blessed, because I don't believe the age really matters. I believe the message matters. And I was blessed to run into Tom F. that night at that first meeting. And he, you know, he listened to me. I raised my hand when they asked if there's anybody new, because I saw other people doing it. And I'm Dave, and I'm an alcoholic. And he came up to me after the meeting and said, "Son, I don't know if you're an alcoholic or not, but I'll promise you one thing. If you're an alcoholic and you keep drinking, it'll get worse and you'll die." Now, if any of you ever met Tom, he's a little Irish guy. And he's got this jolly kind of laugh. And he laughs at his own jokes all the time. He died this year. But he would go, this is what he said. He said it like this. You know, "Son, you know, I don't know if you're an alcoholic or not, but if you keep drinking, it'll get worse and you'll die." And he goes, "Ha ha ha," and he walked away. I was like, man, he's a senile old guy, right? He's a senile old guy. That man watched me for the next 3.5 years. And when I would come back and pick up on the front of my big book, is what I hope is the last of these aluminum 24-hour chips. In those 3.5 years, I've picked up enough of them to have a good-sized poker stack. I am great at quitting drinking for one day. Next to that, in those 3.5 years, next to that big pile, I stacked them up when I got sober in 1990. I had a box I would throw them in. Wooden box that sat on my dresser. Next to that was 3 little red aluminum chips that were 1 month. So what that tells me is I'm really great at stopping drinking. I probably stopped drinking with a sincere desire for a new way of life 30, 40 times in those 3.5 years. Out of that, Less than 10% of that, I was able to get a month. And one of those, I was locked away in treatment. Next to that stack of three was one lone three-month chip. That shows me about how far long I can go on willpower. I'm great for a day. If it's really bad and I'm really in trouble, man, I can make it a month. And if you lock me away in a treatment center and feed me antabuse every day, I can make it three. But I drank twice on antabuse for 6 months over. Almost 6 months. Didn't quite make it. So that's the kind of powerlessness I have. And I'm not talking about forgot to take it for 3 months and then took it. I'm talking about took it going out the door and 2 hours later I'm drinking on it. I'm talking about a mental obsession so powerful that there is nothing, even medical fact, that drinking on this chemical that is in my body is going to make me feel horrible, cannot keep me from taking that drink. That I will lie to myself and drink even when all facts and all evidence points to the fact that I should not drink. June 23rd, 1990. It had been a really great couple of weeks. In and out of AA for 3.5 years, treatment centers, picking up countless one-day chips. They started off 2 days before with me wind up getting locked up for assault and battery in Baltimore. No big deal, right? I wrecked another car. That's no big deal. It's about the fourth one. I'm only 22 now, right? So people are getting tired of, you know, I'm wrecking everything that I own and I'm wrecking the things that I borrow from other people. So now nobody wants me to drive their car. Nobody. Grandparents, parents, nobody. You know, friends, no, you can't drive my car. I wind up having the second one of those little blonde cheerleader girlfriend types look at me with that disgust and that pain and the tears running down their face. And she put her finger in my chest and said, "I wish I never would have met you, you SOB, you'll never change." And those words echoed through my mind, "You'll never change, you'll never change." And I had, in those 3.5 years, been beaten down to the point where I could no longer blame anyone else. You know, when I finally got around to writing the fourth step, you know, there was largely one name on the list. There was a few others, largely mine. I know it was me. I didn't want to be the man I was. I knew I couldn't change. I knew she was right. And I felt terrible for what I was doing to her and the people that loved me. You know, and I wanted to look concerned. I wanted to make the promises, and I couldn't make the promise again. And the last thing that was happening is, you know, I had a friend come in from out of town that next afternoon. We started drinking at lunchtime. Somewhere during the afternoon and evening, I lost him, wound up with a bunch of my other crew, you know, that were, when we talk about sort of the sort of evolution of our drinking to, you know, sort of decent people when we get down. And believe me, like I said, I was the lower companion. You know, I was getting 12-step by, you know, I was having interventions, you know, with guys who were, you know, sticking needles in their arms and drinking every day. And there's something wrong with you, right? I mean, that's bad, right? When you're the worst out of that crew. When you come to in the crack basement, right, after drinking all day, right, and you got a gun in your hand and you don't know if you're doing show and tell or if you're about ready to shoot somebody. I just got here. I'm out of blackout. You got your gun too. Wait a minute. You got mine. I got yours. I guess we're comparing guns. That's okay. That's the kind of life I began to live. And I told you how I was raised. Good people. Taught well. Right? People who sacrificed a lot for me. Drinking and in sobriety. I got tossed off the second story of a parking garage that night in a fight. And it wasn't much as fights go. This kind of group I ran around with, I had fights all the time. And I wasn't a tough guy. My nickname was Crazy Dave. It wasn't Gangster Dave. It wasn't Badass Dave. Right? It was Crazy Dave. You know, I'd do things like I'd carry guns and I'd pull them out and I'd just shoot them every now and again just to let you know just how crazy I was. And I kind of had one of these crazy episodes where I got in a fight with a guy over who was sitting in the front seat of the car on the way home from the bar. And I started it. And it wasn't, as fights go, it wasn't all that dramatic. I hit him a couple times, and the other guy I was with said, "Oh, Crazy Dave, God, you're going crazy again, right?" You know, I had that moment of, "Oh yeah, I am going crazy. I should stop." And when I stopped, which was breaking one of my fundamental rules of street fighting, which is you don't stop until the person in front of you is completely debilitated, the guy tackled me, and I don't think he meant to do it, but there was a parking garage wall behind me, one of those walls that goes up about this high, and when he tackled me, I went over, fell 20 feet, landed right on my head on the concrete below. And I was 22 years old, the whole side of my head got caved in, and by the time they got me to the hospital, I had damn near bled to death, and my brain had swollen. Half my body was paralyzed, and the prognosis was that I would die that night, most likely. If I lived, I would be brain dead. I was 22 years old. That was the early in the morning of June 23rd, 1990. God, I hope that that was my last drink. I hope and pray. And I believe with the power that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, it can be, if I keep doing what I've been doing the last couple decades, you know, and what you all showed me to do, and the love that you all have given me. And I came to that hospital bed, and my grandfather, the World War II vet, greatest generation guy, you know, now you can imagine being raised by a man like that. One of the fundamental things, men don't show pain, men don't cry. And you'll tell that a lot's changed in who I am and the way I speak. You'll see the emotion, you'll hear it in my voice. He held my hand and I looked at him because I knew he was a man of great integrity and honesty. And I looked straight into his eyes and I said, am I going to die? And his hand began to shake in mine and a tear ran down his cheek. And I'd only seen that man cry twice in my life, and that was when he buried his parents. I knew the answer. I knew it was over. And I could tell by the way I felt. There was a guy named Thomas Merton, who's one of my favorite spiritual writers. And Thomas Merton, before he became a monk, had a near-death experience. And very much had squandered his life, squandered the life God had given him. And as he laid there near death, he uses these words, and they're the most poetic thing that I've heard to describe what I felt. He said, there's no need to look when death is in the room. You can feel it in the chill of the marrow of your bones. And I can tell you that there's a coldness and a darkness that I felt that night that I have never felt before and have never felt since. And I don't know about the fiery gates of hell, but I can tell you about the cold, dark void where there is nothing. And it's terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. And I felt that night, and I looked at my grandfather with what he described as terror in my eyes and asked him that question. And when I got that answer, I pleaded. Heard a guy named Frank Lynch say once, the dying men don't pray, they plead. Another one of the heroes. Another one of the giants. Right? They plead. And I pleaded to a God that I didn't believe would help me that night not to let it end this way. I pleaded that it not end this way. There was part of me that knew it was over, but there was part of me that knew that at 22, it is not supposed to be over. This is not the life that I was intended to lead. This is not the death that I was intended to die. This is not the way it should end. One more time. God, please help me. And he did. He did. He didn't give me the Bill Wilson bright light experience. You know, I didn't have him in the room. You know, I didn't have immediately, you know, raised from the bed, perfectly restored, you know, with a dozen AA members and some donuts and coffee, you know, taking me off to a meeting. That guy, Tom Flynn, I came to about 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning that morning. And I'd have these moments that night where I would be awake for a minute and out for hours and then awake for a minute or two. And it, just as my eyes popped open, I was all alone in the hospital room, probably about 3 in the morning. My family was off in a waiting room or off somewhere. That grandmother was a woman of great faith, and she was off. You know, I really believed in my early sobriety that my prayer, my desperate prayer on that bed that night is what changed things. You know, I talked to my grandmother a little bit of it that night as I got sober later on, and she told me what had happened. That when I looked at my grandma, she was on the other side when I looked at my grandfather. I was like, she said, your eyes rolled back in your head, and we thought you were dead. And she said, I reached up. I laid my hand on your head. And she said, God, I've never asked you for anything directly in my entire life, and I've done my best to serve you. But I will ask you this. You make this boy well, or you take him home tonight. Don't you leave him this way. And she was a woman who, you know, in the book of James, right, and we see it a couple times in our big book, who believed in that faith without works is dead. Man, and she got busy. She got busy at 2 in the morning, right? And so she's calling, she's pulling out numbers. She's got, you know, she's got her prayer group. She's getting them out of bed. She's getting the minister out of bed, right? And I can just imagine these, you know, these blue-haired, you know, Christian warriors rolling out of their bed in the moo-moo, right, on their knees praying for Shirley's grandson. And there were some that I met who told me they did. You know, and I'm not so arrogant tonight to believe that perhaps the prayers of some good Christian men and women who got out of their beds in the middle of the night to pray for Shirley's grandson, that may not have been the thing to turn the tide. I'm not so arrogant to believe that. The other thing she did was she pulled out a phone number that guy Tom Flynn had given her personally when he hadn't heard from me the last time I went out drinking. He had taken the time to go see her personally. As it says in our chapter 7, working with others, it says to do, to look for that time when the opportunity may present itself, when we can be of service. And he gave her his number. And he said, surely the time may come when it seems like all is lost. The time may come when it seems like he's without hope. And if you call me, I will come. Because he believes in man's darkest hour is often God's golden opportunity. And that's exactly what he did. He came to that hospital at 3 o'clock in the morning. And just so happened, as grace would have it, that the moment he crossed the threshold into that hospital room, my eyes popped wide open. And I watched that man's expression as he looked at me in that hospital bed go from sort of concern to compassion. And he walked over to me with, you know, if I think of what the eyes of the carpenter must have been like. And he looked down at me with this great love and great compassion and great power and conviction. And he put his hand on my shoulder. And I'm covered in my own vomit. I'm paralyzed and there's blood coming out of my ears still. And I still don't know if I'm going to live or die. And he said, son, it never has to be this way again. It is not over. And that began my walk with you. That was my example. Tom was that beacon of hope. I didn't realize it at the time, but it was a little spark in the dark, 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 darkness. It said, maybe, just maybe. I doubt it. I've been around you 3 years, and I didn't get it. Maybe, just maybe, you all are right. Maybe, just maybe, this will work. Maybe, just maybe, this is my moment. This is my time. Maybe, just maybe, God might stand me up one more time. And if he does, I'll do whatever they tell me. I'll give everything I got. Now, I didn't have much left. Isn't that funny how we give up when there's literally nothing left to give to God. Like, here you go. Well, thanks for that. I was really looking for a crappy life like that. Wait, I got to build you before you're any use to me. You know? I got tons of work to do, you know? Got a 1972 Pinto, right, with no motor and the whole side busted in, right? Thank you for that, Dave. You know, I'm really going to get far driving that car. And things began to change, you know. I was in that hospital for a couple weeks, and one day didn't go by that you all didn't come in 12-step. And the first night I got home, I couldn't drive. I stayed paralyzed for a couple months. It looked like I had a bad stroke. And food would fall out of my mouth when I ate. And I kind of talk like this, and my one eye wouldn't shut. It would stay open all the time. So I kind of, that's what I look like. I mean, that's what I talk like. And I was like that for a couple months, and after a few weeks, they figured I wasn't going to die. You get stable. And what that means is they'll send you home to suffer there. And they sent me home to suffer. And I'm a mess. I mean, there is nothing. The girlfriend's left. You know, physically, I'm destroyed. Mentally, I don't know where I am sometimes. They're called seizures, apparently. And I knew who I was, but I'd be like, I'm standing at a podium. Wonder who you all are. I guess I'm talking. Wonder what I'm talking about, right? That's the kind of things that would have happened to me. And so they call it now, they've got a term like traumatic brain injury, right? Big words. They didn't have that stuff 20 years ago. They just said, well, we'll see what happens. Neurologists go, I don't know. Maybe. It might be this way the rest of your life. You might not. Don't know. And you all came to my house that first night I got home. I was terrified. I when I got home, for some reason, the reality of it all hit me. This is what my life is going to be like. You know, I'm severely disabled. I don't even know where I am. I've really done it. I'm 22 years old. The rest of my life is a long time. You know, nobody's around me. My family's kind of taking care of me out of obligation. They're looking at me going like, boy, you really done it this time. You know, we were hoping to have a retirement. Now we're going to take care of him. You know, I could see it. I could feel it. I could taste it. And then a doorbell rang. Poor members from my first home group led by my sponsor walked in. They brought a meeting to my house because they heard I couldn't get out and go. You know, that's powerful. When you do that for somebody, it changes. And that little spark of hope grew a lot that night. I looked at the eyes of those men. My sponsor was sober 10 years at the time. The other men that were with him were all sober less than a year. And I looked in their eyes, and there was something that they had that I wanted. And I thought, my God, maybe one day, I doubt it, maybe one day I could be like them. I could be like Jerry with 9 months. or like Jim was 6, or maybe even John with 3, because he's got a light in his eyes at 3 that I never had. I can see it. And I never did something like this. Maybe my life can mean something. Maybe God can use me for something like this. Maybe one day I can do for somebody what they've done for me. And I've had that chance to repay that debt. That debt never gets repaid, you know that. But I've had the chance to show up and look at the eyes of men and women like me when they can't get out and go to a meeting and try to bring the hope that was brought to me that night to them. You know what I found out? What you already know. Is it in that they may or may get it? They may or may not be changed like I was. But I'm changed every time I do that. I'm changed for the better. And that's what I found out here. Is that so much of what I do is, I do it because I feel like I've got a debt of gratitude to those giants that went before me that took their time. But I do it because I love it. Because I love who I am when I'm with you. I'm at my best here. Absolute best. We're not at this podium. I'm at my best when I'm out there with you one-on-one. Or when I'm talking to the guys I sponsor, or when I'm trying to share a little bit of hope with a new guy or a new gal. That's when I'm at my best. When I'm with you. So I got 10 minutes to tell you about the life that I've been blessed. I told you this was going to happen. I try with that paragraph in the beginning, but to me, so much of the transformation continues, but so much of that transformation right around the time that I got sober, so much of the desolation and destruction of alcoholism in those last 3 years, and that turning point and that transformation in the first couple years, to me, is just such a dramatic example of the power of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can't help but to spend a lot of time on that. Because the contrast between the darkness and the light, when I look back, that's the greatest. And I think that's really what we're here to really kind of share with one another, is that transformation that can happen here. That really is supernatural. There is no logic that can explain what happened to me in that life where I went from literally being on the bed, brain dead, to celebrating a year of sobriety. Right? In a year. I'll talk a little bit about that transformation in the physical, mental, and spiritual context. Physically first. I told you what I look like. Right? I go to a neurologist every 2 weeks and he goes, Right? After doing that for a couple months, he goes, but I think we're going to have to sew that eye shut because you're about ready to go blind. Because my eye wouldn't shut, so it was drying out. And so we're going to have to sew that shut because we don't, you're going to go blind in there and we want to keep that eye good. Great. Thanks. Appreciate the good news, Doc. I go back a couple weeks after that and he puts up 2 MRIs on the screen. And I see him looking. And, whenever you see, especially these PhD, MD types that have gone to all kind of specialty school, right? They spent, decades in getting educated on their profession. And he's looking, baffled, at two MRI images. So I got an MRI earlier that week, and I've been getting them every couple weeks, right? Go and get the MRI again, stick in a little tube, right? Makes lots of noise, right? And he's looking, and I see him looking down the corner, down there was where, the patient name and information was. And he turns at me and he looks, and I'll never forget this. Kind of like catching that beer in my hand. As much as that was a spiritual experience, I saw when he turned and looked at me, I remember that moment because that was a transforming spiritual experience for me. When I began to really believe that God in this room was powerful enough to do anything. And he looked at me with his baffled look. And he said, this is exactly what he said. He said, son, I was young then, so a lot of people call me son. He said, son, I don't know how to say this. But in 2 weeks, your brain has been rebuilt. You're not going to be paralyzed any day now. And the next day, I wasn't paralyzed anymore. The next day, I began to stand upright. And I began to be able to look people in the eye. That'll get your attention. And he said this at the end of that. And he looked at me, he's still baffled. And he said, I don't know what you're doing, but whatever you're doing, keep doing it. That's exactly what he said. And I knew what I've been doing. I've been showing up with you. I've been letting these gray-haired guy Tom dragged me to meetings all over the freaking tri-state. We'd be down here in Virginia, down with Al's group. We'd be, over in Delaware at Wally's group. We'd be up in Pennsylvania, right, carrying the message up there at all the treatment centers in New York, and all in 1 week. And I was praying in the morning to ask God to help keep me sober and show me what His will for me was that day. And at night, I'd say, thank you. I knew that's all I'd been doing. And I knew there was power in that. That moment, I knew. And I don't know why God chose, chooses in some cases to take somebody like me and do a big miracle like that. In other cases he doesn't. I don't know. But I know that he wants me to tell you about it. That was nothing through my own work. That was nothing. That was just pure grace and power. And perhaps he did it only so that I can share with you the power that lies here. So physically he restored me. Pretty much 90%+ like that. Got my attention. My sponsor Tom gave me the whoa, whoa. He said, because I was telling him about now I was ready to, go make some blind people see, some lame people walk, right? And he said, whoa, 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 whoa. He said, we used to call it the whoa, whoa, when you get the whoa, whoa from Tom. Whoa, 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 whoa. He said, Dave, God, I'm not denying God has done an amazing work in your life. He said, but son, let me tell you, you stick around AA, you'll see it happen day in and day out. Age of miracles is not over. It happens every day here. And that's what I've seen in the last couple decades. It's not just my miracle. It's kind of old news. 20-some years ago. It's a big deal, right? For me. I've watched it happen over and over and over again in your lives. Sometimes they're different. They reveal themselves in different ways. And I'm a good member of my church. I love the church. But I tell you what, I don't see the hand of God do the things that I see done here, the way he does it with the consistency and the brilliance. What I see in Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't see anywhere else. And I'm blessed to be part of it. I want to be part of that miracle creation. I want to be part of that miracle happening every day. Mentally, I had a chance to, I got unparalyzed, and my sponsor was great about these things. He'd say, now what are you going to do? I'm like, I don't know. I was planning on being like disabled the rest of my life. I just got unparalyzed. He said, weren't you in the university? I said, yeah, I was in the University of Maryland. He said, what were you studying? I said, engineering. He said, what year were you in? I said, in my junior year. He said, well, I think you ought to go back to school. I said, I know the neurologist said my brain was rebuilt, but Tom, it's a junior year of an engineering curriculum. I'm not sure I was smart enough before I got the whole side of my head smashed in. And he said, you probably aren't. And he laughed. He said, but look what God just did for you. He's gotten you sober. He restored you physically. And he said, besides which, what else are you going to do? I said, I don't know. He sent me to talk to a Catholic priest who was also, we were on a spiritual retreat. He sent me to talk to a Catholic priest who was also a professor. And I talked to Father Kohler, and he's no longer with us either. And what he said to me is, he said, Dave, he said, God does amazing things. Why don't you show up and see what happens? Ask for his will to be done. If he wants you to get an education, you'll get an education. And so I showed up, and I did what you all taught me to do. I showed up day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. When I had class, I sat. I came to the class. I got there early. I stayed after, right? I found a group of winners, and I tried to bring more to that group than I took. Day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. Just like everything else in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's about consistency, not brilliance. And not only was I able to graduate, an undergrad degree in engineering. I graduated the outstanding graduating senior in my department. Same university had me on academic probation when I went back. I was the outstanding graduating senior in their department. That same university that had me on academic probation said, we've got some graduate work if you'd like to sign up for it, and we'll even pay you to do it. I'm like, great. You can pay me to stay in school. I told my grandparents that. My grandfather, 7th grade education. Went to work when he was in 7th grade. Quit school and walked away. That man said, son, I'll see you through as much education as you can get. And they did. Man just didn't make it out of middle school, saw this kid through a PhD. That goes to show you the kind of giants, your shoulders. I've been blessed to stand upon. And day after day, week after week, month after month. I went back, got the master's degree about 18 months later. They said, we got one more, we got a PhD, you want to do that? And I said, I knew I can't do this. But I also knew that I couldn't say no. And I came to a point where, right about a year or so after that, I was sober about 4 or 5 years, and I met her, my beautiful wife April in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she was the piece that had been missing, right? I got sober, I worked the steps, I did that fifth step with the sponsor, on the shores of the Severn River, first ever spiritual retreat I'd ever been to, and I realized I became part of you. I got de-uniqued. I became part of the we. For me, when I shared that fifth step, I got the first word of the first step. I realized I wasn't any different. I wasn't any worse. And that gray-haired old gentle Irishman with that crazy laugh, he had done a lot of the things that I had done. He had been a lot of the places I had been. And I could tell that God loved him and he wasn't there anymore and I didn't have to be either. And I got a lot of the promises. I got the promise that, you know, in the fifth step when it talks about, you know, being on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. I got that promise. And I went on and I had a chance to do the rest of the steps, and you know, and then there was a period of a couple of years where, you know, I got to celebrate that first anniversary. I knew sobriety worked, and I began to go back to school, and I began to see the principles work in school. But there was that area of my life left. It was that hole of that family and of that longing to have someone to share my life with. And it was a lot of fun doing the dating thing for a couple of years in AA. That's a whole other discussion. And I have that discussion a lot with the young people. It's not a lot of fun. It's a lot of trial and error on both sides. And I'm sure there's plenty of women who would say the same about the experience they had with me in those days. So, but my picker got better. And my ideal got more spiritual. Right? And there she was one day, my beautiful wife, April. But I learned that you can't just go up and like ask them out right away. You got to stalk them a little bit, right? find out if they've actually got a program. Because I found out, you know, part of the reason why, you know, I stayed away from new women who were, because one, they're crazy, and if you're trying to live by spirit, it really hurts. So I learned that, and it's bad for them too, but I knew it was bad for me. So, you know, so I watched her for a while, and she had a good sponsor, and she was working the steps, and the smile was genuine, and there was a warmth in her heart. And I looked on my ideals list. I made an ideals list, and I'm like, check, 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 check. And there's a couple things on there that I didn't even have on there that I see in her that I love. It surprised me. And I asked her sponsor for permission to ask her out. So that's the way we do it, right? 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 Is that the right way to do it? But her sponsor knew me, right? And I think had, you know, knew I had a decent program. So I knew I was kind of probably good in her eye. And she gave me permission. I asked her out, and we've had an amazing life. It's been almost 20 years ago, and she just celebrated 20 years. And so we've been on this path together. And so about this time, I'm coming to the, you know, I meet April. We decide we're going to get married. Finishing my graduate degree. We're building our life. We're looking into the future. Build a house. You know, I found out I could build a house if I wanted to. Read some books. Show up. Build a house. You know, do that kind of stuff. Allowed me to do all kinds of things I never thought I could do. I certainly would never been able to do drinking. And built our first house, and we get married, and then she tells me one day she's pregnant. And I'm just, here it is, man. Chance to be the kind of dad I wish I would have. But here I am in graduate school, man. I'm not the kind of dad that's like ready to take care of a family. You know, we're doing okay. She's working full time by now. She's now taking care of me, seeing me through the last bit of my grad school. I can't make it. I gotta quit. It's not getting done. And so I go to my sponsor and I tell him I'm going to quit. And he reminded me that we don't quit in Alcoholics Anonymous. We make it or we fail. He said, David, have you given it everything you got? I said, no, Tom, I've probably given about 80%. He said, you give 110 and then you come back to me when it doesn't work out and then we'll talk about this. Give it 110% for 6 months. I gave it 110% for 6 months. And it wasn't working. I went back to him one day and I said, I've given it everything I had. I said, give it one more month. And I went in one day to the lab that I worked in there, and the PhD wasn't coming together. The wife was very pregnant now, and the promise had been made that I would have a job by the time her maternity leave was up, and the baby was born, my beautiful daughter Summer. And so I went back to that lab, and one day I just showed up, and it was done. It was done. And I don't think God cares about another PhD engineer on the face of the earth, but I think he cares that I tell you that there's so much power in this room. The guy can make you whatever you want to be. And if nothing else, it just shows that there's enough power to take a brain dead guy laying on the bed and make him a PhD. You know, I had a chance to teach the courses that I quit before I failed out of. To stand up as the professor of the same class that I couldn't make it in. You know, that's power, right? That's what lies here. You know, one of the greatest blessings that I've had over the last probably 10 years is a chance to watch my children grow up. We had our son James 12 years ago. And I've had a chance to try to be that dad. Not a perfect dad. But in our family, there's principles. And there's love. And there's joy. And we've had a chance to do some amazing things together. You know, my kids were born in AA conventions. Literally. One was at the Maryland State. My wife went to labor at the Maryland State Convention. And my son, I left the Ocean City Convention I was speaking at to come home and have him. And then we used to take him to Ross, remember? You know, we'd bring him to conventions with us. They'd be running around the back room. They were raised in Alcoholics Anonymous. Their aunts and uncles are guys and women that April and I sponsor. That's their extended family. I was just out in the Rocky Mountains skiing about a month and a half ago with a bunch of the guys I sponsored. took my son with me. He's 12 years old. You know, and we were talking about it with the guys that I sponsor, and they said, you know, we're the guys. We're the same guys. This is what he gets to see. You were sitting on a box in Richmond, Virginia. Your kid gets to sit in a room with sober men who are about spiritual principles, skiing the Rocky Mountains. Now that's something I'm thrilled to have been part of in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We've seen the world. Got the chance to live in England for 3 years. And I'll wrap up, I promise. I know I'm out of time, way out of time. But I just want to end with this. You know, we had a chance for the work that we do. I had a chance to move to England for 3 years and took the family there. And you know what I found? The same AA that I got taught in Anne Arundel County in Maryland 23 years ago, guess what? The same AA works in Cheltenham, UK. The people that were doing the steps, guess what? They stayed sober. You know, it was small town AA. But I saw exactly the same thing. I got a chance to have a sponsor and be a sponsor. I got a chance to watch the magic work there. Then I got a chance to take my family and see the world from there. You know, we stood in the cathedrals of Europe, you know, Notre Dame and New York Minster. You know, we've stood in St. Peter's and Rome, and you know, and the kids are they're bored of old 1,000-year-old cathedrals. My kids learned how to snow ski on the Swiss Alps in Switzerland. You know, my son and I got to climb on the pyramids of Egypt together. You know, we've been so close as a family that we could pet a male lion in the Serengeti in Africa. You know, we've had a chance to see the world together. I've had a chance to watch that through my children's eyes. And the only reason I've been able to do these things and have these experiences is because Alcoholics Anonymous not only got me sober, but gave me a God and gave my wife a God and gave our family a God and the power and a set of principles by which we can have an amazing life. And so I wish and hope the same for you. And I'll end with this. It's off of page 25. And this has been my experience of what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of our shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others. And we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. And I thank you for that. Amen.